From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from the director of the new movie The People vs. Larry Flint. Milos Forman says he wanted to direct the film because he grew up with censorship under the Nazis and the communists in Czechoslovakia. He'll talk about that period of his life. His other movies include Amadeus, Ragtime, and Hair. This weekend, Showtime premieres the new movie Bastard Out of Carolina, directed by Angelica Houston. It's adapted from the novel of the same name, about a girl who was sexually abused by her stepfather. We'll hear from the author, Dorothy Allison. She based the story on her own childhood. And film critic John Powers reviews two new movies, Jerry Maguire and Mars Attacks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Clinton holds a news conference this afternoon where he will announce replacements for his cabinet. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
White House sources say that President Clinton will introduce his new Secretary of Commerce today, Attorney Bill Daley, the brother of the mayor of Chicago and the man President Clinton turned to lead the fight for the NAFTA trade agreement. Daley is considered to be a tough and competent negotiator who has the political instincts President Clinton believes are necessary for all his top economic policy officials. President Clinton will also announce that New Mexico Congressman Bill Richardson will be his new ambassador to the United Nations. Richardson, who is Hispanic, has become a globe-trotting hostage negotiator, extracting Americans from such places as Sudan, North Korea, and Iraq. The president will also announce that Attorney General Janet Reno will stay in her post. Many White House officials complained that Reno has been too quick to appoint special prosecutors to investigate the White House, but because of the ethical controversies, it was considered politically difficult for the president to ask her to leave. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Sources also say the president will tap Gene Sperling to chair the National Economic Council. A federal judge has rejected efforts by Unabomber suspect Theodore Kaczynski to be tried in California on charges he murdered an advertising executive in New Jersey. The judge ruled the case, like others, should be tried in the federal district where the crime was committed. Defense lawyers wanted the case to be heard in Sacramento. That's where Kaczynski is facing two other murder charges. A 47-count indictment names seven current and former law enforcement officials in Chicago's western suburbs. It accuses them of fabricating evidence in a murder case against two men. David Shaper of member station WBEZ in Chicago reports.
The two were set free a year ago after spending 12 years in prison for the 1983 rape and murder of 10-year-old Janina Carrico, after one investigator admitted that he had previously lied in the case. Bill Kunkel is a special prosecutor appointed to look into allegations that evidence was intentionally fabricated. Some fear that the criminal charges he has filed may erode public confidence in police and prosecutors.
These charges are not an indictment of the DuPage County or Illinois or American system of justice. These charges deal with specific conduct by specific individuals in a single case.
Kunkel says there's a thin line between vigorous prosecution and misconduct, and in this one case, it was crossed. For National Public Radio, I'm David Shaper in Chicago.
In Singapore, the U.S., Japan, and 26 other countries have agreed to a deal that eliminates tariffs on a wide range of high-tech products by the year 2000. The products include computers, telephone headsets, and digital photocopiers. The agreement was hammered out under the umbrella of the World Trade Organization. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 3 points. This is NPR News. The nation's largest veterans organization is asking Congress for a formal probe of possible criminal wrongdoing by the Pentagon. It centers on missing logs from the Gulf War that could help explain whether thousands of veterans were possibly exposed to chemical agents. The American Legion says it wants the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee to investigate the disappearance or convince the White House to undertake the probe. The committee has been holding hearings this week onto the subject. At issue is the whereabouts of military logs documenting 8 days in March of 1991 when U.S. troops destroyed an Iraqi weapons depot. The Pentagon has denied any attempt to hide information. A fight between Mexico and the U.S. over brooms has prompted Mexico to slap tariffs on 8 American products as of today. The tariffs are in retaliation for duties the U.S. is charging on Mexican-made brooms. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
Under the terms of the two-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement, Mexico and the United States are supposed to be lowering, not raising, the tariffs they charge on the goods and services they import from each other. But there's a clause in the NAFTA Accord that allows duties to be raised on imported products that are harming domestic producers. That's the argument the U.S. has used to reinstate tariffs on Mexican straw brooms. More than $500 million worth of the brooms were exported to the U.S. last year. Mexico has responded by raising tariffs on 8 American imports, including notebooks, flat glass, fructose, and some alcoholic beverages. Mexican officials say they plan to ask a NAFTA dispute resolution panel to resolve the trade spat. In another dispute, Mexico recently agreed to limit its winter tomato exports to the U.S. I'm David Walna in Mexico City.
The FBI says a meteor shower is most likely what was seen by a crew of a Saudi airliner before dawn yesterday in the skies near New York's Kennedy Airport. The streak was said to be flare-like. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday we heard from Larry Flint, whose pornography empire and First Amendment battles are the subjects of the new film The People vs. Larry Flint. The film is directed by Milos Forman. In the introduction to Flint's new memoir, Forman writes that he doesn't like pornography, but he believes in freedom of expression. Forman grew up in Czechoslovakia, when freedom of expression was suppressed, first by the Nazis and then by the communists. On this archive edition, we have a 1994 interview with Forman discussing that period of his life. Forman began his film career working under the communist bureaucracy in Czechoslovakia. His Czech movie Fireman's Ball played at the New York Film Festival in 1967 and was his ticket to the U.S. His American movies include One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Hair, Ragtime, Amadeus, and Valmont. Forman was a child during World War II when the Gestapo was in charge. After the war in 1948, the communists took over. Both of Forman's parents died in Nazi death camps. His father was on the fringes of the underground. One of the Nazis responsible for the death of Forman's parents had been one of their employees years before.
My parents built a very small 15-room pension, or little hotel, if you want, in former Sudetenland, which was the part of Czechoslovakia which was taken over by the Nazis first, by the Germans first. And as a kind of a foreman on the building of this pension in 1920-something, I was not even born, was a German citizen there. And I know that my parents were very fair people and they treated him fairly. But when the Nazi came to power, suddenly this man, of course, was somehow humiliated that he worked for some Czechs, which is, you know, not a race or nation, which is, you know, up to the Nazi or German stature. And by sheer coincidence, this man ended up in the Gestapo in Kolin, which was the town under which Czaslav, a little town in the middle of Bohemia, was under. And when he got all these names, and he saw the names of my parents, first my father and then my mother, he just stamped the paper with a stamp which said the return undesirable. And that's it. And then they perished.
Your mother was taken by the Gestapo after they came to search your house. What was it like? You were, I think, 7 years old or something?
8 years. With mother, I was 8 and a half. Yeah, I was 8 and a half years old. I was sick that day, and I was, I had a fever, I had a flu, I was in bed, and I heard, you know, that some voices downstairs, because we were living in a little house, you know, one-story house in Czaslav, and for a long time, and I knew that something is strange, because I heard that strange noises from downstairs. And then I hear steps coming upstairs, and then the door open a crack, and my mother is there, and she's handing me a cup of water and a pill, and says, no, take the pill. And I said, but I shouldn't be taking the pill until the afternoon. The Gestapo is here. And she just gave me that. So I took the pill, and I, you know, the door closed, and I saw a man standing behind her there. And then I realized why she's telling me that, because I was my bedroom was a tiny little room behind which was another tiny little room to which the door were covered by a cupboard. And to keep the fresh air in, the cupboard was always a little bit away from the door. And I realize that she wants me to push the cupboard back to the wall so that it covers the door, and when they come to my bedroom for search, that they will not find it. But I was too weak, and the cupboard was oak wood and very, very heavy. I took all the things out, and I was trying to push it back and push it back, and I didn't succeed. That was the most horrible feeling, because I felt like I failed my family. The irony is that then when they came in and found out, you know, this other room there, they went in, they looked around, they went out, they were even smiling at me. And then they went down again with my mother. But then I hear the door click, and then there was silence. And this was, you know, they came like 8 o'clock in the morning, and this was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And there was silence. And I hear the car going away from in the street, and there is a total silence. They just didn't even let my mother go upstairs and say goodbye. And I am alone, absolutely alone in the whole house. And there was nobody in the town of Čáslav, you know, who would come home.
So what was it like for you to go through the rest of the war without parents?
Well, that's another big paradox. You know, a child doesn't really perceive the tragedy like that. Especially, you know, I probably would be much more stricken by grief if my parents died yesterday than when they died when I was a child. And because child doesn't really perceive the finality of life. The death is, especially in these cases, because they were away. They were somewhere.
Right, you didn't know they were going to die.
So you don't know they are going to die. They are somewhere. And then one day, somebody tells you, in this case it was my uncle, told me, listen, my sister, your mother died. But in my daily life, nothing changed. You know.
So you had family, extended family to bring you up, uncles?
Oh, my relatives were taking care of me, yes.
I want you to recall a specific day during the war, and this is a day that must have had special significance for you. It's the day that the Germans decreed that all the art houses had to close, the theater, the ballet, the orchestra, the movies. Were you already interested in the arts when that happened?
I was very much. Well, not interested. I was seduced because I was a child again. You know, I was 10 years old or 11 years old. And my brother, who is 12 years older than I am, he was like 23 years old. He was a set designer for a traveling small group, theater group company, which was playing operettas. And every time when they came to town where I was living with my relatives, you know, I was every day, I was backstage. And, you know, I was just mesmerized by the atmosphere of the theater. And because I was a little kid, you know, nobody kicked me out from the ladies' dressing room, right? So that was very, very exciting. And then, you know, I didn't know anything, you know, why it's happening. It was the most weird experience because I remember very well, Polish Blood is the name of the operetta. It's a very fluffy, light operetta. And this was 1944. And suddenly in the third act, during a very merry kind of a song, it was like a quartet or a quintet, and then the ballet dancers and things on the stage, suddenly the singers stopped singing and started to cry, tears running down. And the orchestra stopped, conductor stopped. The people in the theater were sitting silently, quietly. Nobody was sort of upset or surprised. I just didn't know what's happening. Then the conductor tried to start the aria or the quintet again. They started to try to sing again this very merry, happy song. And again, in the middle of the song, they broke down and in tears and cried. And then the man came on the stage and said, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you understand the emotional state of the artist who will not be able to finish the performance today. Thank you for coming. It was so nice. Good night. And the curtain went down, and that was the end of culture. Because I didn't know that the day before, the Germans just canceled culture. The next day, every single singer, every single dancer, every single musician had to go and enlist himself or herself in a factories to work for the victory of the Third Reich.
My guest is film director Miloš Forman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back to our 1994 interview with Milos Forman. He directed the new movie, The People vs. Larry Flint.
Let me skip ahead to a few years after World War II, when the communists took over Czechoslovakia. Do you have specific memories of that?
I remember that, you know, it's, again, very, very strange thing to realize. I remember I was in the boarding school, and I was in the fifth grade and of the gymnasium, which was, you know, and we were traveling from the school in the nature, from the mountains, and when we were standing and waiting for another train on the train station in Mladá Boleslav, where from the loudspeakers is coming a speech by the president, then you know, Communist Party chairman Gottwald, announcing that the communists took over the country. We just you know, before we had any time to absorb the propaganda of this evasive social justice which the communists based their propaganda on, we didn't have time to be influenced by it. So when we heard this speech, we realized that this is totally hypocritical, you know, and unreal.
Were there things that you liked to do as a boy that you couldn't do after the communists took over because it was too bourgeois?
I never thought about these kind of things. You know, you adjust, especially in the communist society, because there are no alternatives. You know, it's you are told what you can do, what you can't do, and if you don't want to do what you can do, you are not allowed to do anything. So you adjust, you know, you just accept the limitations imposed on you.
You ended up trying to go to theater school. You were rejected from theater school and ended up in film school, which I suppose was really lucky.
Well, for me, definitely.
Lucky break, yeah. Had you seen a lot of movies growing up?
Oh, yeah, in the film school. It was another paradox of communist society, because it was the best school I could ever be going into, because after the communists took over, they purged from public life the best writers, the best filmmakers, the best artists in the country, because they were not enough in creating in the vein of socialist realism for them. So they purged them, but they couldn't kill them. They had to give them some chance to make a living, so make a meager living in teaching. They were not allowed to publish anything publicly, to books or make movies or work in the theater, but they were allowed to gain meager salary as professors. So the result was that at the film school we had the best minds, the greatest artists, which were teaching us, which we could talk to.
Milan Kundera
was one of them.
Yeah, wrote The Unbearable Lightness of Being was one of your teachers.
Yes, Book of Laughter and Forgetting, The Joke, you know, wonderful books.
One of the things that you did, I think this was while you were in film school or just afterwards, you hosted what you describe as a sort of Czech socialist realist Thursday night at the movies show on TV. So what was the show like? What made it the social realist version?
Well, the social realist version was that, first of all, the paranoia and of the communists to control every word which goes to the public. And television was only live. In that time, there was not Ampex and or tapes at all. So it had to be live. So but they had to control everything. So you had to write everything down, learn it by heart, word by word. The censor was sitting somewhere watching you, checking if you are saying exactly the words which you had to send the text to the office, to the Bureau of Censors. They had to put a stamp on it, send it back to you, eventually make some corrections, you know. Then you had to learn it by heart, and then they were checking if you are saying it exactly, which was sometimes absolutely ridiculous, because you are sort of, I was doing it like a improvised, like a live dialogue, conversation with somebody.
So what would you say to introduce a film? Do you remember any of the introductions you did?
All the introductions had to, you know, I was always trying to show on the television films which had some, you know, which were not just the propaganda films, but then, of course, that you had to present them in the way which the communists would accept. If it was film from France, for example, if I don't know, Children of Paradise, beautiful, romantic film, but you had to stress that this film is showing the cruelty of bourgeoisie, how it's suppressing the working class people, you know.
Did you believe any of that?
Of course not.
But you learned to say it.
Well, you say it because, you know, it's because everybody knew it's nonsense.
Right.
It's a game. It's a game, you know.
When you started writing and directing movies, did you have to avoid what government officials would have defined as bourgeois subject matter?
Well, that was something else. When you do the movies, you know, I tried not to speculate what would please them. And I was lucky. Because for some reasons, they think, you know, my first films were comedies, basically, in films in Czechoslovakia. And they perceive comedies as something not as important, something light, you know, make it, you know, it's just funny, you know, it's just like that. So I was able to do these films very much the way I wanted to do them.
One of the best known of your Czechoslovakian films was Fireman's Ball, and this was a comedy. And in the version that's in circulation now, I don't know when you put this part in. I mean, I know you put it in the late '60s. The film opens with you in front of the camera explaining that, first of all, Fireman's Ball was released just before the Dubček leadership took over, and that the film had a very surprising reaction. 40,000 firemen resigned in protest against this film.
Well, they were ordered to resign. This film was banned. This film was banned right away when it was finished, and was banned, officially written for eternity.
No, why was it banned? You said comedies weren't considered as dangerous. Is this a comedy?
Well, they thought it's a metaphor on the Politburo and the Communist Party, you know, that Fireman's Ball Committee, right? That it's a metaphor for the whole leadership of the country, so they banned the film. No, that was orchestrated by the government people, this strike or the threat of practically all the volunteer firemen in the whole country to... because they needed, you know, the people were so apathetic already, you know, they didn't give a damn. But of course, if the people read in the newspapers that, oh, well, tomorrow, if your house is on fire, just say, kiss the house goodbye, because the firemen are on strike, rightly, because they are upset about this film. So, you know, that turns people's anger against the artists, against the films, filmmakers, you know.
Were there any fires that you were accused of being personally responsible for? And did you feel responsible for any of it?
No. They didn't go on strike.
Oh, they didn't really go on strike.
They provoked this threat so that the government can say that they have a right to ban the film. So when the government banned the film, the firemen said, all right, so now we know that.
Director Miloš Forman is my guest. Now, where were you when the Soviet tanks rolled into Czechoslovakia?
I was in Paris in that time. I was in Paris working on a script for my first American movie. And that's where I learned about it.
And your family was still in Czechoslovakia?
My family was still there, but my French friends, Claude Berry and Paul Rassam, drove in car, which they borrowed from François Truffaut, to Prague to bring my wife and my children out, which was such a, you know, ridiculously, absurdly funny story, you know, because they crossed the, when they, everything was fine, but when they crossed the border, the Czech population, when the Russian army, you know, was occupying the country, just to confuse the Russians. So they either turned down or turned around all the street signs, all the signs on the roads, on the crossroads and everything. So they, you know, there was no way so that the Russians are confused and couldn't find anything. And it really took, you know, several weeks before they found some places of their interest. So when Claude Berry and Paul Rassam crossed the border going to Prague, suddenly they found themselves, you know, driving around and around, seeing deja vu places because all the, you know, signs on the roads were wrong. When they realized that they, tried to stop some people, you know, And finally they stopped the motorcyclist who said, "Oh, yeah, I'm going to Prague, just follow me." And he started to drive. So they are now driving, following this motorcyclist. And in the middle of, you know, this wild ride through the countryside, the Pole suddenly had an urge to take a leak, right? So he said to Claude, "Stop, I have to take a leak." "What do you mean to stop? You know, I stop and, we'll lose him, we'll never find Prague." "Well, what was this? Well, just open the window, roll around the window, do it out of the window." So he climbed into the back seat of the car, and when he's doing it out of the rear window of the car, suddenly a colony of Russian tanks is coming against, And they, see, they could take this as a provocation. So Claude, by driving the car, the car just grabbed, Paul and just, pulled him back into the car. And, he just sprinkled all over the François Truffaut's new Daimler, car. But then finally they reached Prague and they brought my wife and my children out.
Miloš Forman, recorded in 1994, he directed the new movie The People vs. Larry Flint. Here's music from the soundtrack featuring the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from Farrar, Straus & Giroux, publisher of The Christmas Mystery, a holiday tale by Jostein Garter, author of Sophie's World. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Dorothy Allison on her novel Bastard Out of Carolina. Her story about incest and violence in a poor South Carolina family has been adapted into a new film that premieres Sunday on Showtime. Also, film critic John Powers reviews the new movies Jerry Maguire and Mars Attacks. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, Bastard Out of Carolina, directed by Angelica Houston, is about violence and incest in a poor Southern family. It premieres Sunday on Showtime. The movie is based on the semi-autobiographical novel of the same name by Dorothy Allison. On this archive edition, we have a 1992 interview with Allison. Dorothy Allison has said that she hates most books on incest and considers many of them to be pseudo-porn. When I asked what makes her think people use books about incest as a turn-on, she told me because her stepfather used to keep a pile of them under his bed. This is the stepfather who used to abuse Allison through her childhood. Allison said she tried to avoid the pitfalls of the literature of victimology by being as honest as possible. But being honest means describing the disturbing, confusing thoughts of the victim. You'll get a sense of that from this reading, a third of the way into the book.
It's essentially about the point where she's old enough and things have progressed enough that the abuse has become unavoidable. I didn't daydream about fire anymore. Now I imagine people watching while Daddy Glenn beat me, though only when it was not happening. When he beat me, I screamed and kicked and cried like the baby I was. But sometimes, when I was safe and alone, I would imagine the ones who watched. Someone had to watch. Some girl I admired who barely knew I existed. Some girl from church or down the street, or one of my cousins, or even somebody I'd seen on TV. Sometimes, a whole gang of them would have to be trapped into watching. They couldn't help me. They couldn't get away. They had to watch. In my imagination, I was proud and defiant. I'd stare back at him with my teeth set, making no sound at all, no shameful scream, no begging. And those people who watched admired me and hated him. I pictured it that way, and I put my hands between my legs. It was scary, but it was thrilling, too. Those who watched me loved me. It was as if I was being beaten for them. And I was wonderful in their eyes.
You understand this fantasy of having people watch you and admire you as you're beaten but remain defiant?
Yes. It's curious because it's what I did as a child, and I've talked to other survivors, and it's one of the ways in which you can fight the feeling of being this contemptible being. Because basically when you're subjected to that kind of abuse, as a child, you almost always begin to feel that it's justified, that there is really something wrong with you, that you're this terrible person that this is happening to. And the only way I ever found, really, to deal with the emotional onslaught of those feelings was to begin to feel like a martyr, this almost Joan of Arc figure in my own mind.
Something that really upsets the girl in this story. She hates the beatings, she hates the incest, she hates her stepfather. But she's turned on by the stories she tells herself about the beatings.
Yes.
And masturbates to those stories that she makes up. And she feels terribly guilty about this.
Absolutely.
And she thinks that maybe she's as guilty as her stepfather is. Mm-hmm. That's something you understand too?
Oh, yes. And it's hard to explain to people on the outside of the experience, mostly because it's really hard to admit that you could take that experience and convert it into your own erotic charge. I don't know how to explain it. I don't know how to analyze it. I simply know that it happens and it becomes a way to make it your own experience.
I think one of the reasons why someone might be reluctant to admit to a feeling like that is not only their own kind of fear at what they were feeling, but also the fear that somebody would say, well, see, that must have meant she enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
You know?
It's like the myth of rape, you know. Obviously, if you orgasm during rape, then it must not have been rape. So if a child begins to feel erotic excitement while being manipulated by an adult, does that give the adult permission to do it? It's a horrible thing to even imagine. And part of the reason to keep it a secret and to be quiet about that feeling is that you might give someone any small measure of encouragement to feel they have a right to do this. They have no right ever to sexually touch a child. It's just not possible to do. There's no justification for it. And the fact that the child might, in fact, manufacture some erotic excitement is not a justification for it. But if we pretend that it doesn't happen, then that guilt, that self-horror stays, never goes away.
When you hear about somebody having experienced sexual pleasure while they were being victimized.
Well, what upsets me is that they're then ashamed of themselves for it.
Uh-huh.
That I find upsetting. We don't have, especially if you're a child, I mean, my incest started when I was 5 years old. I wasn't capable of making any decision about what I wanted to do. I didn't have the capacity to do that. If when I began to feel all these funny feelings that I could not explain to myself, all I experienced was horror. I began to think that I was the terrible person I was being told I was. And it's taken me most of my life to make the decision that that's not the case.
Did you punish yourself when you were young for feelings that you thought you shouldn't have?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think there's any way that that does not happen. Because you can, you feel like that the worst thing you do is if you don't automatically just hate and abhor everything. Especially if it becomes a trade-off, you know, like, all right, if this day he doesn't hit you and you something else happens and you start thinking, well, that wasn't so bad, then your guilt becomes enormous. I think that's where some of the most excruciating damage is. That's where it takes place.
In the self-punishment.
Yeah. And in this concept of yourself as this horrible, sick person, you begin to feel like it's your fault. And the worst thing is that you begin to feel like the perpetrator is your victim. And that's, of course, something that the perpetrator always encourages.
That the perpetrator is your victim, would you explain that?
Well, I can't talk for lots of other people. My experience was my perpetrator always was saying, I just can't help myself, you know, it's just you, it's just you. And you tell a child that often enough and they'll begin to believe you.
There's something very flattering in that, too, isn't there?
Well, it's a kind of backwards flattering if what they're doing is something that horrifies you.
Right, right.
But the attention can be flattering.
That's what I meant. Yeah, that's what I meant by somebody that's telling you basically that you're special.
Yeah.
You know?
And you're engaged in this enormous drama.
Mm-hmm.
This is the thing that I don't think people talk enough about. That can be very exciting in a way. You know, every day is a new piece of the drama. Now, every night is a horror because you're going back into this absolute pit of shame and self-contempt.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Dorothy Allison. Would you tell us the story your relatives told you about how you were born?
I was born in a car accident. My mother was on the way to the airport with a bunch of my uncles and aunts, and they hit another car, and she was in the back seat asleep. So she was thrown over the front seat, through the windshield, over the other car. She wasn't hurt too bad, except that she had a concussion and was unconscious for 3 days. And, of course, I was born while she was unconscious, which meant that my grandmother and my aunts were at the hospital, and they got into an argument while talking to the clerk and didn't manage to manufacture the manufactured marriage my mother had been going to get through. So I became a certified bastard.
How old was she when she gave birth to you?
15, 1 month past her 15th birthday. She was a child.
How old was she when she married? She did eventually marry, right?
My mother married 3 times. Well, the first marriage was annulled. But she married my stepfather when I was 5, and lived with him until she died.
And he was the man who abused you when you were growing up?
Yes.
Did she know about it?
Yes and no. One of the things that's hard to explain to people is that my mother knew because I told her. Actually, I didn't tell her. I told one of my cousins who told her. But it's very hard. What's hard to explain is that she did not let herself know all of everything that was happening. She couldn't have. And when I grew up and I would go home and talk to her, we would have these very long, slow, painful conversations. And she was enormously guilty that she had not been able to stop it. And she tried. That's one of the hard things that I try to show in the book is like my mother, Annie in the book tries desperately to prevent what she sees happening, even though she doesn't see a lot of what's going on. And she tries to protect her children. She believes absolutely that the man she loves is going to change, that what's happening is just because he can't find a job, because his father is mean to him, because he's hurt and wounded, that she thinks of him as this little boy that she's going to mother into being a good man. And she cannot believe that that's not happening.
So you must have been very angry with your mother for staying with your stepfather after she knew for certain what was happening to you.
Not until I was in my 30s did I really start to get angry at her in that way. My mother loved me. My mother spent her whole life desperately trying to make my life and the lives of my sisters better. She literally worked herself to death, taking care of us, of trying to make some small difference. And if you had ever had a way to meet her, you would have met someone that was just extraordinarily loving and a very large soul human being. And I was madly in love with my mother. And I knew how impossible her life was. She worked as a waitress her whole life. The best job she ever had was as a cook. She was constantly sick. There was enormous bills. She never, never got her life under control. And she always thought if she just worked a little harder, did this little thing more, it would be possible. That having her there, having her like this barrier between me and what was essentially a really cruel world, I loved her enormously. I could not possibly have been angry at her while I was at home. And for a long time after, she was my heroine. It was only when I began to really deal with the problems in my own life that had resulted as being, that getting out of being the victim and into being a survivor was when I started to get angry. And it was nightmarish to be angry at her that way.
What kind of terms were you on when she died?
I went, the month before my mother died was the first time in 20 years that I stayed in her home. Up to that point, I had always, when I got money together, I'd send her a plane ticket and have her come visit me. I did not go home. I refused to stay in my stepfather's house once I was an adult. but that last, I was there 2 weeks in the month before she died, and I left. When the day I left, she told me it was the best 2 weeks of her life, because it was one of the last chances we had to really talk. And she had finally stopped being so guilty, and we could really just be with each other and love each other.
She was still living with your stepfather then?
Yes.
My guest is Dorothy Allison, author of Bastard Out of Carolina. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1992 interview with Dorothy Allison. Her novel Bastard Out of Carolina has been adapted into a new movie that premieres Sunday on Showtime Cable Network. Dorothy, I'm going to ask you to read something from the preface to a collection of short stories that came out a few years ago. And the collection of short stories is called Trash. Would you read the opening of the preface for us? It's titled Sure. Deciding to Live.
I became the one who got away, who got glasses from the Lions Club, a job from Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, and finally went to college on a scholarship. There I met the people I had always read about, girls whose fathers loved them innocently, boys who drove cars they had not stolen, whole armies of the middle and upper classes I had not truly believed to be real, the children to whom I could not help but compare myself. I matched their innocence, their confidence, their capacity to trust, to love, to be generous against the bitterness, the rage, the pure and terrible hatred that had consumed me. And like so many others who had gone before me, I began to dream longingly of my own death. I began to court it, cowardly, traditionally, that is, in the tradition of all those who had gone before me, through drugs and drinking and stubbornly putting myself in the way of other people's violence. Even now, I cannot believe how it was that everything I survived became one more reason to want to die.
Why do you think you went through a self-destructive period after having decided to live and getting away from home?
Oh, dear, it's like math. It's like one and one. You take a child and rob that child of all self-esteem, you will get an adult that has no sense of their own worth. I spent a good portion of my late teens and early 20s trying to find a way to die without having to actually take the responsibility to kill myself. It's a direct result. I've seen it in so many other people. I've seen it in some of my younger relatives. It's a devastating impact. The hard thing is to change it, to crawl out of that black depression and begin to think of yourself as a human being like other human beings instead of a monster.
What helped you do that?
I'll tell you the truth. I think it was feminism. I began to believe that there was an explanation for what had happened to me. And I came to it largely through a political understanding. I went away to college and somebody talked to me about Marx and showed me, you should be a communist. They said you're working class. Well, I'm not much good at that because communists need to do what they're told. But I started reading and trying to study. Why is it that these things happen and why is it that everybody especially believe that incest and violence happens to poor and working class kids? And I lucked into a study group, a feminist study group. And all of a sudden, it was bigger. It wasn't just that we were poor. It was because I was a girl child and because girl children in my family are taught to endure and survive and not to fight back. And that began to let me be angry. It began to let me believe that I wasn't this monster that deserved what had happened to her, but somebody who had fallen under somebody else's madness.
You did something that it sounds like nobody else in your family had done before. You left home. You went someplace else. You tried to have a life different from the lives you had seen around you. How did you make that move?
Oh, I did something. I did a number of things nobody else in my family had done before. I was the first person in my family to graduate from high school, the first person to go to college. There have been two since. And I have come of an enormous family. It's just that... Both of my sisters dropped out of high school in the 9th and 10th grade. It's just not something that we were given the idea that we could do. But a lot of it had to do with my mother. My mother believed that I was this incredibly special person, that I was brilliant. She thought that I was just amazing. So when I was 5 or 6 years old, she started getting me books, and she started saving money to send me to school. She would put quarters in a tip jar. She did it my entire childhood. The point I went to college, she had almost $200, and she'd been saving for more than 10 years.
Wow.
It wasn't exactly a life in which you could keep money.
Yeah.
But that, if you make that decision with my mother's encouragement, believing that I was different, a lot of other things come along. The poor get these funny kinds of encouragements that or kind of backhanded encouragement. I mean, it's true. I got my glasses from the Lions Club when I was 7 years old. That's how I finally got glasses. I got scholarships to college that were largely based on the fact that we were very poor. So you get those Kiwanis Club awards. Now, those things are marvelous, and it's really wonderful, and you desperately need the money. But, Lord, they make you feel like such a... like an animal, like a startling and surprising animal.
Why? So,
because, of course, you're the special one. You're like the freak amongst this family of trash. And somehow everything you do becomes a reproach to the rest of your family. the fact that I was so bright and won so many prizes and awards and things drove me away from my family. I didn't have any choice about leaving. I didn't know how to talk to them after a while. The hard part was going back.
Right. There's a scene in your novel where the sheriff comes after an incident of abuse to talk to the girl. And mm-hmm. she looks at him and she thinks, "You're my stepfather."
Yeah.
And she looks at a lot of men in positions of authority and just sees them as, you know, her stepfather in a uniform.
Yeah. For a long time, that's how I thought. And I think that power over dynamic is a big part of authoritarian men. But the thing I have also learned is that it's not the case for all men. It would be so simple. You know, the tempting thing about that kind of analysis is if you said, aha, the problem must be in that Y chromosome, will just get it out. But that's not it. I've learned that there are authoritarian, abusive women. what it is that power over the weak that's the problem. And that's something you can't explain away easily by sex or gender.
Well, Dorothy Allison, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dorothy Allison, recorded in 1992, her novel Bastard Out of Carolina has been adapted into a new film that premieres Sunday on the Showtime cable network. Allison will appear on Showtime after the movie to discuss this controversial work. Coming up, a review of two new holiday movies. This is Fresh Air. Every year between Thanksgiving and Christmas, Hollywood proudly serves up high-minded pictures like The Crucible or The English Patient that are destined to win awards. But Hollywood has always been about breezy entertainment, and film critic John Power says that the best holiday movies this year are comedies. Here's John's review of two new films that open today.
Jerry Maguire may be the year's least expected treat. A Tom Cruise vehicle that's actually funny, well-written, and full of surprises. Cruise plays the title role, a big-time sports agent who likes doing his job but doesn't want to be a monster while doing it. This gets him fired from his big firm, and soon he's left with only two friends. One is his sole client, Rod Tidwell, a second-tier wide receiver played by Cuba Gooding Jr. The other is his adoring assistant, Dorothy, a single mom played by Renee Zellweger, an offbeat newcomer with a wince of a smile. The movie's biggest surprise is Cruise, who does something he hasn't done in years. He actually connects with the other people in the movie. Normally, Cruise is off in some private superstar dreamland where he barely seems to notice the other actors. But here, writer-director Cameron Crowe has gotten him to relax and pay attention to his co-stars. The result is his best screen performance since Risky Business. Cruise shows us Jerry's blend of selfishness and decency, capturing the desperation of a once cocky man, as when Jerry talks to his client Rod in the locker room.
I'm out here for you. You don't know what it's like to be me out here for you. It is an up at dawn, pride swallowing siege that I will never fully tell you about, okay? Just, God, help me. Help me, Rod. Help me help you. Help me help you. Help me. You.
I'm sorry. You are hanging on by a very thin thread. And I dig that about you.
Jerry Maguire is so thoroughly enjoyable that it's easy to overlook its weaknesses, such as the gratuitous and unexpectedly misogynist scenes featuring a group of bitter, unattracted divorcees. There's also more than a tinge of unconscious racial condescension in the conception of Rod, another of those black movie sidekicks who wind up hugging the white hero. Rod is little more than a cliché, equal parts sass and street wisdom, but he's kept afloat by Gooding's hilariously energetic performance and crow's ear for sharp dialogue, which is par for a Hollywood movie. In fact, more than any other movie this year, Jerry Maguire works the old big-screen magic. It takes an implausible story, whose ending we expect from the beginning, and handles it with such wit and warmth that we're delighted to accept what we know couldn't be true. The question of truth doesn't even come up in Mars Attacks, a piece of inspired tomfoolery that had me giggling nonstop from beginning to end. The story is like a farcical version of Independence Day, in which evil, cartoony-looking Martians wreak havoc on Earth, wiping out Congress in Las Vegas and confronting a ragtag group of Americans that ranges from President Jack Nicholson to the incomparable Tom Jones, who obliges by singing "It's Not Unusual." Along the way, the movie sends up politicians and generals, womanizers and gamblers, militia types, CNN, and the music of Slim Whitman. If you've seen Beetlejuice or Batman, you know that director Tim Burton's imagination is a rainforest of ideas. There are enough visual goodies here for 10 movies. But while Burton's head teems with comic notions, he's only a middling comedy director. Mars Attacks would be even funnier if its jokes were better timed, and it were spared a couple of clunky performances, most notably by Nicholson, who's too leaden for such frothy material. Luckily, most of the acting is wonderfully lighthearted, especially great bits by Martin Short, Pierce Brosnan, Rod Steiger, Sarah Jessica Parker, and Annette Bening, who plays a new-age alcoholic who talks to her 12-step group about her hopes for the arriving Martians.
I'm feeling so optimistic because of the Martians. We're not alone in the universe. And it's so perfect that it's happening at the beginning of the new millennium. Our planet was suffering with the ozone and the rainforest and so many people unhappy in their lives. And then the Martians heard our global karmic cry for help. People say they're ugly, but I think they've come to show us the way. I think they've come to save us.
Burton obviously had a ball staging this goofy invasion of Earth. You can almost hear him chortling, "Warner Brothers gave me millions of dollars to do this neat stuff." His pleasure is infectious. As I giggled and giggled, I kept thinking how much I preferred Burton's idiosyncratic spoofing to the corny bombast of Independence Day. While both are supremely silly films, Mars Attacks is incomparably better because it knows exactly how silly it's being.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Shurrock. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Living Language, publisher of book, audio, and CD-ROM foreign language instruction programs. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
People who are responding well to the new AIDS drugs are beginning to plan for the future instead of planning for death. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with two people in that position, photographer John Dugdale and psychotherapist Robert Levithan. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.